Securing your agency's data is paramount. IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, offers a tailored solution for federal agencies. Protecting sensitive data isn't just about safeguarding. It's about ensuring availability, recovery, and reliability to support mission-critical operations. As an IBM Platinum partner, 4Inc trusts IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, for unmatched speed and efficiency in securing, accessing, and ensuring the integrity of vital data. Visit FOURINC.com.
MSW Media.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Clean Up on Aisle 45. It is Wednesday, August 24th, and this is episode 84. And I am in a hotel, and I think Andrew is in a hotel. We're both traveling. I'm here tonight for the live show that will have already happened by the time you listen to this episode at Largo in Los Angeles. And let me tell you, it was awesome.
But you should travel back in time and go attend that event.
And then, I'm joined today by Andrew Torres. Andrew, where are you in the world?
I am in a hotel in Rochester, New York, getting ready to say goodbye to my one and only son, who is headed off to college. So tomorrow, the day before when you're hearing this, I will have walked out the door, walked him to his dorm with all of his worldly possessions, and I have all the feels that a dad could have right now. So that's me, change of life, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Allison?
I'm doing great. I don't have a change of life. Like, I'll be walking onto a stage with like Kathy Griffin and Midas Touch, but that's a little different.
That's your usual stuff.
I don't have a nest to empty, so my eggs are deviled, but here we are. And that's, that can be tough, saying goodbye. I think of it as not saying goodbye, but like just saying hello to adulthood. Now you're pretty soon you'll have a cool dude with money to drink with.
We've already had that kind of relationship because we went our last couple of vacations were in Europe. And so believe me, Alex is a big fan of the like, oh, hey, I can drink wine here at 17. Like, so, but there we are. Emotional, mental vibes for me to get through this time period. And if you would like, you could also sign up to be a patron just like these fine folks. I'm going to give a big shout out to Das Fergand, to Wendy McKinley, Donna Cray, Barbara Panning, Fraud, Vichy Sois, everything, which is just a fantastic pun. I love that. That is both pun and dad joke, so I love it. Gwen Ma, and something in the butter. So thanks to all of you for supporting the show. You want to do that? You know how to do that. Just head on over Patreon, patreon.com/ Aisle 45 pod, AISLE45POD. Sign up, give us as little as a buck an episode, and you'll get to be on our Zoom call. That's always a lot of fun. And any other goodies, we give away special bonuses, stuff like that. You know, we don't say we love some listeners more than others, but we love some listeners more than others.
Yeah, and when I was a karaoke host, I swore it didn't matter if you tipped me or not, but it totally did. I'm like, no, I have a very, you know, I'm a mathlete. You know, I have a very intense data driven process about how I put everyone in order. It's just really based on how much money you give me. But you know, it helps keep the show afloat. We don't do a lot of advertising here. So we, you know, that's what I really just got to send the love to all of our patrons, because you are the reason we can do this. So yep. thank you from the bottom of my heart. And holy shit, today to get right into the news.
Yeah. We have a holy shit kind of week to sum up.
We sure do. And first of all, we're going to talk about the latest in the Mar-a-Lago search warrant, Donald Trump, 18 different defenses, but none official, you know, issues. Although I do think, has he actually filed? We'll talk about it.
Yep.
But it's more hilarious to me than legal. Then we're going to talk about Lindsey Graham and what came out from the judge in that case, the 11th Circuit, I believe, one of the more conservative circuits, helping delay this whole stupid thing. And then, of course, I want to talk a little bit about what I did, a full hour-long special on Mueller, she wrote, for patrons of Daily Beans this weekend, that Bill Barr March 2019 memo that has to be released. And we're not going to cover the whole thing because we've covered it in depth on other avenues, but I do have some questions still unanswered that I'm going to ask a real-life lawyer, Andrew Torres. And then we will talk about this Weisselberg deal, because we have feelings. We have feelings about the Weisselberg deal, don't we?
Yeah. Wow. That seems like an awful lot of work. So let's get to it.
Yeah. Let's jump in. Let's kick this off with Mar-a-Lago. So what did Judge Reinhart say today?
Yeah. So this, the oral arguments, the hearing was conducted in the afternoon on Thursday of last week. Right. So the 18th. And at that oral argument, I was a little surprised, right? Because the ruling from the bench was to order the DOJ to produce for an in-camera inspection a redacted version of the supporting affidavit. And I had predicted...
Here's 27, no, probably closer to 150 pages of just redaction bars the and hello and... why and my, like it's like rando words here and there.
I made the catch 22 joke on opening arguments, but you know, right, like, so Yossarian censoring everything out except the salutation dear Mary and the signature, and then, you know, writing in I yearn for you tragically, A.T. Tapman chaplain,
we
US
did
Army.
The we did, yeah. We did the Schrodinger's affidavit over
right,
on the beans
right.
Yeah.
But I had a slightly different view coming out of the hearing, because if you would have asked me, you know, move your chips in on the table, you know, what are your beans for this? I would have said, I think that the judge is just going to deny the motion.
I did think that. That's what I did. And that's what I said. And that's where my beans were. And my beans were wrong. Well, and we don't know yet.
Yet. Exactly. And so to have things come out, you know, sort of fairly critical of the DOJ led me to believe, okay, well, you know, maybe we miscalled that. At the end of the day, I don't think we miscalled that. And I think that now that we have coming
now
out
we're looking
today,
at this, came out today, it's like
we're looking at the actual written order. This is a dynamic that happens sometimes. I want to lean back on, you know, I have been taken to task by some, including atheist Captain America Andrew Seidel, who thinks that the fact that I don't pay attention to oral arguments is particularly at the Supreme Court level is incorrect. I've long said oral arguments are not a basis for trying to read the tea leaves. And this is a good illustration of that, because very often a judge will, use oral arguments as an opportunity to answer sort of lingering questions that that judge has as a result of reading the briefs. But the fact that he's been super hard on one party doesn't mean that he's not coming down on that party's side. It means that, you know, that those were where the questions were, right? And right, he wanted to hear the answers. And
that's, that happens all the time, right? Like what this judge is doing is sort of establishing shit that he doesn't want to come up if you know, people try to overturn his decisions, right? And it makes sense too. Like everybody got really mad when this particular judge asked in the hearing that happened last week was like, would you, the media, be okay if the Department of Justice redacted some stuff in the affidavit? If I decided to release it, would you be cool if they redacted it? And everybody lost their minds. Like people thought that the judge was asking the media for permission to get for redactions. And that's not what was happening. That was just establishing so that way the media can't come back later and argue, hey, we never asked for these redactions, or we oppose these, or we'll just file a thing to oppose the redactions and delay. And that way he's kind of clearing it all up, you know? And so that's why, like you said, we can't always rely on what happens in a hearing to look forward to what they're going to do. And that's seemingly with this release, because Andrew, yep. the four things. Let's dive in.
Yeah, and let me. I just want to bring that point to a close, which is, good lawyers will concede when the law is uncertain, right? Like I can't tell you the number of oral arguments where I've had where I've said, "Look, I'm 80% sure that the law is on my side," right? Or the majority rule is on my side. Here's the minority rule. Here's why it's a bad idea to apply that in this case, right? And so all of those things come into play. You might have more uncertainties about the case that ultimately the side that you're going to come down on. And I feel very confident that as we've read the written documents now, this is why I'm a documents guy, that's what's going to happen. So first and foremost, we learn right out of the gate, bottom of page one, this was the question that you had asked me, that all the media interveners have requested to release the affidavit. The government opposes the request to unseal, and then, quote, neither former President Trump nor anyone else purporting to be the owner of the premises, Mar-a-Lago, has filed a pleading taking a position on the intervener's motion to unseal. I cannot tell you how crazy that is, right? We see these leaks out of Trump's Truth Social garbage platform every day about, oh, we're going to move for a special master. We're going to do X. We're going to do Y. Well, the problem is that he's hired a lawyer right now who I can't tell if she's ever practiced law, right? Her last gig was bobblehead on OAN. When someone has executed a search warrant, you don't hang out for 3 weeks and decide like, you know, we'll write something when the time is right. Like you get involved
right, because
now.
Part of your argument is going to be that there's urgency.
Yeah. And it's real hard to demonstrate urgency when you can't write a goddamn brief.
In 3 weeks. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And that's what waiting kind of generates that makes it a big problem for them. I want to talk about, by the way, I thought it was really funny that Politico referred to the movements as media organizations and Judicial Watch.
And Judicial Watch, yeah. I once asked the Knowledge Fight guys, like, how Larry Klayman got kicked out of Judicial Watch. And they told me, like, it's a story that's known in right-wing circles, but I immediately forgot it and no longer give a shit. So, you know,
excellent.
All you have to know is that right-wing crazy Larry Klayman founded Judicial Watch, filed like 9,000 lawsuits against the Clintons, lost 8,997 of them, got kicked out of Judicial Watch by a guy named Tom Fitton, and they're still at it and they're still lunatics. So, they have moved here, to unseal the search warrant affidavit, but they have been joined by, you know, actual news organizations. So there you go.
So what I think the only quote unquote news in this filing is that the court has officially denied unsealing the affidavit in its entirety, which we knew that was probably going to be the case. So there's that. Yay. Yep. Now, in the context, it says, of an ongoing criminal investigation, legitimate governmental concerns about unsealing this affidavit include witnesses will be unwilling to cooperate. And in the filing, the DOJ said, in other high-level investigations, which means January 6th. I thought that was a nice little, hey, yeah, we're doing our work. You can shut up. So witnesses would be unwilling to cooperate and provide truthful information in their if their identities might be publicly disclosed. Of course, especially with Donald. Everybody saw Shay Moss and Ruby Freeman's testimony.
Yeah.
Law enforcement's ability to use certain investigative techniques in the future might be compromised if these techniques become known to the public. Number three, there'll be an increased risk of obstruction of justice or subornation of perjury if subjects of investigation know the investigative sources and methods. And four, the one I've been screaming from the top of my lungs for like the last, that's ever since Trump was like, I want it all released. I'm like, you're going to violate your own rights, my dude. And here it is. If no charges are ultimately brought, subjects of the investigations will suffer reputational damage. It's why we call him Individual One. Yep. And if they choose not to charge Donald, but they choose to charge Christina Bob, it'll say Christina Bob and Individual One. And that's for a reason. And I've talked about this with the Mueller report, and we'll talk about this when the Barr memo comes up, because I see a lot of similarities between the wanting to unseal this affidavit and wanting to get this Barr memo out into the public. Different reasons, and one's right and one's wrong. But, you know, Mueller made it clear that he couldn't say that Trump obstructed justice because he couldn't charge Trump. And therefore, Trump would not have his constitutional right to face his accuser. And that was a constitutional consideration. And that comes up in the Barr memo for different reasons. But this, it applies here, too. So when Trump wants to seek the affidavit, he's actually seeking to violate his own rights.
Yeah, it. I don't know that I agree. I mean, you know, as I said on your show at the time, I don't know that I agree with Robert Mueller's construction of his obligations, but you know, we have.
Well,
heard,
I would have charged him. I think the OLC memo.
Obviously. Yeah.
I just want to put that
we're
out
both there.
The Office of Legal Counsel memo, like that, that was fucked up. He should have charged him and litigated that memo. Yep. He did not. I'm mad at him for that forever. But under the circumstances.
Yeah, because special counsel is not bound by OLC. Anyway, let's not relitigate that. We're on the same page with respect to that. But you are correct, right? Like we have heard Merrick Garland, the DOJ speaks through its court filings. Well, its court filings say, we believe that there is evidence or instrumentality of the following crimes at Mar-a-Lago. It is very, very difficult to square, right? There's a little bit of daylight, you know, between in federal court anyway. In some state jurisdictions, there's none. I learned this recently. There's a little bit of daylight between probable cause and you know, more likely than not, right? But at the end of the day, right? If you issue a declination decision, it is hard to put the genie back in the bottle. And that's why you don't give out the search warrant affidavit until a party has been formally charged. Then you have to under Brady. Yeah. But
yeah, you have to. But and as you and I talk, he'll get it. If he's charged, he'll get it. Somebody will get it. Somebody's getting charged in this case. If it's not Trump, somebody's going to get an indictment. And somebody will get that in discovery, and then they can share it with Trump if he wants to see it. But, you know, I think that the probable cause, you and I talked about this last week, probable cause for a former president executing a search warrant at his residence is going to be jacked up a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not going to be probable cause for me, you know, and that's, you know, it's going to be a little bit higher. It's going to be like, and Merrick Garland, it took him a couple of weeks to be like, we got to do this. We have to do it.
I concur. We could have an argument as to whether it should be that way, but
it shouldn't.
There you go.
It should not.
So we would not have an argument. We would be in a vigorous agreement.
We would be in vigorous agreement because the law should be applied to everyone equally.
I'm glad we agree, but your point about what the law is and what this says when you were talking about traditionalist institutionalists who signed off on this decision, I think is very, very well taken. So the legal principle being applied here in this decision is a two-step process. And the first is to weigh the public's interest, which is significant, against those factors that you described, right? So those factors that weigh in favor of sealing the affidavit are: you could use that information to intimidate witnesses. You could use that information to discover what are referred to as sources and methods used by the government in its investigation. And that is really significant, right? Like, that tells you the way in which they're approaching these cases. Well, if there are other cases in which the same individual may be the subject of future criminal charges, right?
Well, yeah.
You don't want to give those away.
The whole reason Concord Management, which managed the troll farm in St. Petersburg, went to court was to get the affidavit in discovery so that they could learn sources and methods of our investigation, our investigatory processes. They also asked for every sources and methods process we use going back to 1942. But
and the nuclear codes while you're at it. Yeah.
But that was the whole reason they hired some American lawyers and went to court. Otherwise, they would have just been like, F you, we're not responding to your stupid indictment. That's back one of the indictments that came out of the Mueller probe. So that's, they just wanted to get their hands on those sources and methods, which they would have in discovery. Everything was heavily redacted. And then that's why the Department of Justice, Mueller, that they dropped the case. They're like, this is stupid.
Yep. And then this was a point I'd seen you make earlier, but not really in too many other sources, that the affidavit discusses Mar-a-Lago, which is a location protected by the United States Secret Service. So disclosing those details, quote, could affect the Secret Service's ability to carry out its protective function.
It could endanger Donald.
Yeah, it really could. And and again, I'm shocked that you're the only one saying this and that we have to be the one saying this. But remember that I don't believe, and I think we have both taken the same position, I do not believe that Donald Trump gets a check from Vladimir Putin. Right. I do not believe that he is a Russian asset in that sense. I think he is a Russian stooge and a Russian asset in the sense that we know what the cyber attack policy of Russia has been for the past 15 years. And it has been to sow chaos and dissentment and distrust of democracy. Well, if distrust of democracy would be fueled by, for example, assassinating Donald Trump, it wouldn't shock me to see the Russians want to take, to pull that out as well, right? Like, it's not like they have any personal loyalty to him. So,
no, they don't. And in fact, having bad things happen to Donald Trump seems to foment violence in our country, they're going to be 100% for it.
Yeah.
So we definitely need to keep those sources and methods quiet, though I would argue with you about him not be getting a check from Putin. I think a lot of loans were underwritten through a subsidiary of Rosemary Vrablic's Deutsche Bank. But we could, story for
yes,
another day.
Okay. But what I meant. You know what I meant by that phrase. So
right. It's not a Michael Cohen Walmart bag with a boxing glove and $10,000 in cash.
I'm going to call this a retainer. Yeah.
Do you remember that actually happened? God. Do you remember that story?
Oh, yes, I do.
He was rigging a poll and he paid a guy with a boxing glove and cash in a Walmart
bag. Let us not forget, as we watch a sort of, gleeful Michael Cohen living his best life now, that he was still the medallion king of Manhattan,
the medallion stallion. He Jamie Lannistered it, right?
There you got it. That is excellent. I wish we'd use that when his counsel was on. But so
let's talk about these four things, because the judge says, Reinhart says here, who's by the way has been threatened and has beefed up security, that he gives great weight to the following factors. And you were going through those things, right?
Yeah.
Here's
how they break down. Three factors weigh heavily in favor of sealing in his mind. So number one, invading the legitimate privacy interests of those witnesses and opening up them to potential obstruction of justice, witness intimidation, that sort of thing. That's pretty obvious. Number two is the sources and methods that we just discussed at some length. That weighs heavily in factor of sealing. And then number three were the sealed, And then number three was the physical aspect of the premises. And we expanded on that. On the other side of the issue is that this involves matters of significant public concern, which the court takes seriously, that weighs in favor of disclosure, and that large portions have already been unsealed, right? That the search warrant itself, the cover sheet, that sort of thing.
And that cover sheet was actually a lot more significant than I think people realized, because it had these little descriptions next to the code
next
violation.
To the specific code violations. Yeah, that gives you some insight. Yeah. And as it turns out, confirms exactly what you and I said on the show. So our listeners, I think, were a step ahead. But yeah, mainstream press outlets could have explained a bit more that confirmed what you and I have been telling people for weeks. So the court says, and this is an actual part of the ruling that we didn't know with finality. No, we are not releasing those. It's not additive, but the factors favoring sealing outweigh the factors favoring disclosure. So we are not going to release the unredacted warrant, but that leaves open the question, right, of the second half of the legal test, which is complete sealing of the search warrant and its affidavit of a court document, right? Is that narrowly tailored to achieve those governmental objectives? And is it the least onerous alternative, right? Or is there something in the middle that could achieve all of those objectives, but also release some more information to the public? And that's why the judge wanted the DOJ, by tomorrow when you listen to this, to submit a redacted version of the warrant that in its judgment would be sufficient to release, to then judge whether it ought to do so, right?
And I like this because, you know, if let's remember, doodly-doo, back when... Back when the Judge Reggie Walton wanted to review Bill Barr's redactions of the Mueller report to see if they were appropriate. Remember?
Yep.
Remember? And he said Barr made inappropriate redactions.
Yep.
And lacked candor, which was kind of a nice little jab after what happened to Andy McCabe. He was fired for lacking candor.
Right.
Which was total bullshit because he had every authorization to release stories to the Wall Street Journal, but whatever. Anyway, that I like the fact that judges want to go in camera, like we're going to talk about the Barr memo too, and go in camera and look at this stuff and make sure that the Department of Justice isn't redacting stuff for nefarious purposes or inappropriately. So that's kind of what's happening here, right? He's going to look at the affidavit. He's going to make sure that the redactions are for privacy purposes, to not disclose sources and methods, for all the reasons that the Department of Justice says it wants to. He's just going to verify that. And he says here, I cannot say at this point that partial redactions will be so extensive they'll result in meaningless disclosure, but I may ultimately reach that conclusion after hearing from the government.
Yeah. And so there are two things to keep in mind here, that when the government proposes these redactions, again, by noon on Thursday, noon tomorrow, as you're listening to this.
Under seal.
The government will come in and say, notwithstanding that we have blocked out all of our witnesses and all of our ongoing sources and methods, we oppose you releasing even this redacted information, really for two reasons, right? The first is because we think it will be less being stripped of the content and of being stripped of the context that has been redacted will not render this information, and the phrase here is meaningfully enhance the public's understanding of these events, right? Mm-hmm. So it is going to be ripped out of context. It's going to be potentially misleading. You can't quite figure it out. And so we're not giving you more information if we're leading you down a false rabbit trail. And then
do you think they'll argue that it could be dangerous because of what these, you know, what Trump supporters do with this kind of information?
That's a really great question. And
because I've seen some judges and some, and the DOJ in some cases make these arguments, particularly with the election fraud lawsuits, like you're just trying to do a media circus here. You're going to misrepresent this plaintiff, or, you know, the Donald Trump is known, not plaintiff. I guess you would say, I don't know what they would call him in this, but, you know, this side is known for using information in a dishonest way to foment violence or something like that, and then maybe use the FBI in Cincinnati example or something.
That's a good thought. The way I was thinking about it is, think about what you and I do every time we see a redacted or an anonymized filing, right? That is, you know, sometimes it's super easy, right? When it says, you know, individual one, a former president of the United States, right? Well, okay, that's not hard to figure out that that's Trump. But you and I have done that and successfully unmasked an awful lot of individual threes and organization sevens just from the context clues. And I could see, right, the DOJ filing a brief that goes alongside their redactions that says, hey, we have obscured the identity of person X, but here we have a double bind because either we mention person X's occupation, at which point that will fuel a media frenzy for, oh, which real estate developer or, you know, right, whatever.
Yeah, it'll be subject to online sleuths everywhere.
Right. Or we can redact both of that, at which point you're now left with, and I think the words used, this was citing a previous case, was our redactions, quote, would be so heavy as to make the released versions incomprehensible and unintelligible.
And not just that, but, you know, when you and I go after, like, what's under this redaction bar? How many letters fit? Who, you know, we're doing it on good faith. We're doing it in good faith. This other side tends to make stuff up.
Yep. And you know, we have already mentioned witness intimidation. So let's kind of bring this to a close. We may get a redacted version of the search warrant later this week or early next week, but we may get nothing.
I would like to get nothing.
I'm on now on team nothing. I was on team, release the affidavit for selfish purposes. But no, I'm on team nothing, as hard as that is to say. And I think
it's just safer, honestly, for the United States. I think it's just safer.
I think that's right. So we'll keep our eye on it, but that's where that stands. Shall we talk a little Princess Lindsey Graham?
Lindsey Graham. Yeah, I got to tell you, boy, he sure doesn't want to talk for somebody that's so innocent. It makes me wonder what was in the safe in Mar-a-Lago. What are those photos? What are those binders of photos? I don't want to think about it, actually. However, here's, bring us up to date on what's going on, Lindsey Graham. I know Fulton County DA is investigating. Something I found very interesting was in her filing. She said, look, Lindsey Graham, you have to come in. We can't delay this because he has information on new witnesses and we can't subpoena our next batch until he comes in and testifies. And next batch, I mean, you've already talked to the governor, the secretary of state, all 16,
Rudy Giuliani.
The next batch is Meadows and, you know, Trump. That's
people, right? People whose last name is Trump. That is
Cipollone. You know, the very, very high tippy top That's the last batch, because we've already seen filings too under seal for security protocol for their the special purpose grand jury reporting and briefing, right? And the security.
I just have to share as an irrelevant aside, Thomas Smith got a puppy this weekend, and the number one choice for puppy name that people want him to name the puppy is Patsy Baloney.
Yes.
So I think that would be a great name for a puppy. As soon as you said Cipollone, I was just thinking of
what kind of puppy.
Thomas Smith's. It's a golden doodle. It's a
perfect.
A delightful,
that looks like an Irish dog.
Floppy Patsy Baloney of a dog. I will keep everyone posted as to what the name becomes. But so back to actual court stuff. As we were recording, we talked about this last week. The U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Georgia issued an order on Lindsey Graham's motion to quash his subpoena and said, no, you do not have the absolute immunity under the speech and debate clause. You've got to go testify. You want to assert privileges on a case-by-case basis, have at it, but no, you've got to show up and you've got to answer questions. There was then the emergency appeal made to the 11th Circuit to stay the enforcement of that judgment. That came out on Sunday during the day. It is dated Monday, the 22nd.
Yep, we try to take a day off and then...
It doesn't happen.
We get a Graham filing, right. Which at first I was really mad about, but now I'm kind of like, delay now or delay later.
I think you had exactly the right breakdown in it. And so here's what the 11th Circuit said. The 11th Circuit said, we are administratively staying the district court's order requiring Lindsey Graham to show up. We agree that there is no blanket right to quash, but we are remanding back down to the district court for the, quote, limited purpose of allowing the district court to determine whether appellant is entitled to a partial quashal or modification of the subpoena. And
that's the headline.
Yeah.
The headline is the court says you're going to have to testify about something,
right,
my little friend.
Right.
And so then to figure out what that is. Now, a lot of people, my first thought was, why don't you just know and compel him to testify? And then, you know, I play it out in my head. He's going to go in. He's going to answer questions that he can. And then in other instances, he'll invoke this speech or debate clause protection. And then Fani Willis will have to go and litigate it. And then we go through this exercise that we're going through now. We're just doing it ahead of time, which the only, you know, delay now or delay later, sure. But the only thing that, like, bugs me is, how do you know what questions the grand jury is going to ask or where it'll go? And why are you trying to do this before? This is something that, I mean, it's not unusual for people to invoke privileges in grand juries and then have to litigate those privileges. But I mean, it's really gonna, you know, and then also some of the stuff that isn't part of speech or debate that he might testify to might help them move forward with their investigation, and then she can decide whether she cares about what he's invoked speech or debate over or not. So it seems like this is a backwards move.
And I agree with that in large measure. And the real question was, how long is this going to gum up the works, right? And today, 9 a.m., we learned not very, right? So
yeah.
That was my
consolation. I was like, the thing that happened is the circuit court sent it back down to the judge who denied a stay and denied everything for Lindsey, and then said, "You set the briefing schedule." I said, "I bet this judge is going to set a very, very fast briefing schedule."
If you had made that bet with me, I would not have. I would have gone. You know, I would have lost on Price is Right rules. Given this scheduling, here is the scheduling. So remember, we're recording this on Monday, the 22nd of August, even though you're listening to this on Wednesday, the 24th. So Senator Graham has until probably in the past, as you're listening to this, 9 a.m. on Wednesday, August 24th, Eastern Standard Time, to file a motion as to exactly which questions and or categories of information he is requesting the court to address in an order to partially quash the subpoena. So that had to have been filed by now. The Fulton County District Attorney's Office will then get the weekend, right? They get all the way until Monday at 9 a.m., right?
That's nice. August 29th. Two business days. Yep. They're giving everybody 2 business days.
They're giving everyone 2 business days, but let's be honest, and those 2 weekend days, and I promise you those lawyers are working hard over the weekend, at 9 a.m. to file its response. Senator Graham's reply, 2 more business days, is due on Wednesday, August 31st.
I've never seen a briefing schedule this fast. Plus,
1 week from today, we will get Graham's reply brief that brings this all to a complete close, 9 a.m. And all of this now is left in the sound discretion of the trial court judge. Right.
Except he can appeal back to the 11th Circuit.
Sure. But at that point, he will. And the 11th Circuit is a conservative court. But yes. But I will say this, right? It would be very difficult to look at the way in which the 11th Circuit structured this order and the way in which this is going to unfold and to have the and then be able to justify the same administrative need. Now, look, the 11th Circuit is conservative. Kevin Newsom, ex-Covington and Burling, somebody I know, is a Trump appointee to that court, right? So, you know, you have lots of opportunities for a bad result. But you have lots of opportunities, even in a conservative court, for a pretty good result here. And either way, right, we're fast-tracking that. So, you know,
judge actually asked Lindsay for a lot of information in 2 days.
Yeah.
And here, this is where my question comes in. And a lot of people were wondering this in the legal circles. I was texting some of my actual other lawyer friends, but we couldn't understand why the remand, because the district court judge was actually pretty clear about what's covered by speech or debate and what's not. Why the remand? I guess they want like specific questions. I mean, tell everybody what the what Lindsey Graham has to, what's his homework that he has to turn in today.
So the reason we have a remand is because the 11th Circuit put its thumb on the scale and said, even though you did not ask for this kind of relief, that is the partial quashal relief, we want to exhaust that opportunity that you might be entitled to some lesser form of relief before you show up, in addition to the right to present objections as you are asked on a question by question basis. Now, would you or I have gotten that from the 11th Circuit? Hell no, right? So they basically put the thumb on the scale and said, yeah, even though he didn't ask for it, let him ask for it. That's why we're remanding, right? And so the court was like, oh, okay, well then, you go ahead and ask for whatever you want, right, by today. And by the way, we want, quote, the parties should also address whether informal investigative inquiries by individual members of Congress into issues that arguably fall within that member's legislative province constitute protective legislative activity under the speech or debate clause, or to the contrary, whether such protection extends only to investigative inquiries that originate from a more formal congressional source, such as an investigation authorized by a Senate subcommittee. And that was the basis for the district court's opinion, and not the full basis, but that was part of the basis for the district court's opinion in the first place, which was, look, Lindsay, you calling up your buddies and saying, you sure you can't find 11,790 votes, is not a congressional investigation. And if you think it is, we want to see the cases that would support that belief that a senator just kind of calling people is the kind of investigation that the speech and debate clause was meant to protect.
Well, and I feel like Fani Willis is probably like, Jesus Christ, I don't care about your deliberative you know, am I going to certify the election or what election laws you are going to change? That's not the information I need from you. I just need your fucking ass in the seat so I can ask you these three things about Meadows and Cipollone and Trump. So I can do my next round before October 17th, which is when early voting begins in Georgia. You know, so and her email to Kemp, too, was like,
oh,
was
gosh, I wish we had time to go through that. That
I know it was great.
That was beauty. So that's where we stand with Lindsey Graham. We'll know everything will be concluded 1 week from today, but it will, of course, take 2 episodes of Cleanup on Aisle 45 before we get the result. But this is really, again, to have this remanded down Saturday night and Sunday night and Monday morning, 9 a.m. I mean, I was an apple polisher in school, but like that is a quick turnaround. So good result
absolutely.
All the way around.
And I have a new favorite word, quashel. So, which is the noun version of quash, right?
Yeah.
And so my new band I've decided is Estoppel Quashel because those two words go together really well. Or maybe in limine, quashel in limine. Is that a thing?
Quashel in lemonade.
Yes.
And they could, and like I said, I think this needs to be, there's not a lot of demand for this, but needs to be a Seals and Crofts cover band. So,
or at least a shirt.
They'll do nice, you know. Folk songs from the 1960s.
Yeah, Moonlight, Love,
Incense
things like that.
And Peppermints.
Speaking of Moonlight and Love, I had a couple questions about the March 2019 bar memo decision from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, I've gone over this in great detail on a bonus episode of Mueller She Wrote and on the Daily Beans. And on Twitter, because I am following this. There's only like 4 decisions Garland's made that I've been really, really against. And so I follow them like a hawk because, you know, I have some of these red lines.
Yep.
So basic backstory, back in when the Mueller report came out, it was turned into Bill Barr on a Friday. That minute, the minute he got it, he told his Office of Legal Counsel and the PAYDAG, Principal Assistant Deputy Attorney General, I think, O'Callaghan.
Yep.
To whip up an Office of Legal Counsel memo that says why I'm not going to charge, why he didn't obstruct justice. I'm going to start on my letter to Congress now. Go. And so Citizens for Responsibility Ethics in Washington wanted this memo unsealed. And so they filed laws. They asked for it for FOIA. They were refused. They filed the lawsuit. Bill Barr's DOJ came out and said, nope, deliberative process privilege and attorney-client privilege. And deliberative process privilege means we were deliberating about whether or not to charge Donald Trump with obstruction of justice. So because of that, it's privileged. People should be able in organizations to have frank and open conversations without the public knowing about it so we can bounce ideas. You can't see it. Then we had a really great election. And Joe Biden became president. We nominated Merrick Garland. And Garland is picking up the mantle and going forward with the baton of this case. And he decided he was going to continue to fight to keep this document sealed, which pissed me off. So anyway, the Judge Jackson, if you're nasty, Amy Berman Jackson, Judge Jackson decided, nope. Your arguments are bullshit. In order for something to be deliberative process privileged, you have to have it has to be pre-decisional and there has to have been deliberation. And since you already made up your mind, no, you weren't doing that. So it's not pre-decisional. Your argument sucks. Release the memo. And then Garland appealed with the same shitty arguments, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And the appeals court said, no, these are the same shitty arguments. And no, you can't make this new argument that we told you about. You didn't move to make a new argument. And even people who move to make new arguments, we tell them to pound sand all the time. So no, must be released. So here's my 2 questions.
Okay.
Did Garland flop on this on purpose? Did he throw this? Did he do the bare minimum by picking up Barr's shitty arguments and just running with them as best he could, knowing that there was a perfectly good, probably knowing, hopefully knowing, there was a perfectly good argument that could have kept this thing under seal? And that is, there was a decision they were deliberating, and that was how to go to the public with the Mueller report. but they failed to mention that after five motions and a motion, five briefs and a motion to appeal.
Well, and we should point out that we know about that only because of Judge Jackson's decision, right, which unsealed part one of the memoranda, but kept sealed part two. And, you know, you can then read.
Yeah, and that was this DOJ. They were like, yeah, just keep part two sealed. And then when part one came out, we learned what that other reason was. And I'm like, this DOJ doesn't seem that sloppy.
Yeah, it is hard for me. It's hard for me to give a kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down on, you know, whether this was deliberately taking a dive. I want to say a number of things here, right? Like, first, institutionally, institutions tend to defend their own privilege kind of maximally, right? Like, we talked about this in connection with the DOJ's decision in the E. Jean Carroll case, right? And the notion that they were going to defend an expansive view of what counted as performing the official functions of the presidency, right? And that is not surprising. And that is something that, again, you know, you and I have talked about the E. Jean Carroll case at length on both of our respective shows and amongst each other. But I think the DOJ is correct in the view that it took with respect to that, right? Like, you do not want to set the precedent. You do not want your organization arguing, hey, by the way, like, there are times if you harass our guy enough and he's talking that we want you to parse whether he is speaking electorally or as the president. They do not want, right, for whether the privilege to attach to Joe Biden attaches whether he's speaking electorally or in his capacity as commander in chief. They want a broad view. So number one, I wasn't surprised. I was not pleased, but I wasn't surprised to see the DOJ defend the initial position. But I can tell you they have not developed these arguments very well.
No, and there was a perfectly low-hanging fruit argument for deliberative process privilege. And not only that, they didn't they looked at attorney-client privilege and they're like, we're not arguing that.
Oh, yeah,
they completely gave that up. But they dropped that argument altogether and just went with the deliberative process thing, put in their arguments, and then they even came back and apologized about it. The DOJ said, hey, judges, we don't want you to think we were being dicks here when we doubled down on our previous shitty arguments.
Yeah,
you know, so this wasn't in bad faith.
So let's unpack kind of that last bit of the argument, because you've tossed around the two operative legal principles, right? Which is that it must be predeterminative, right? That is, before a decision has been made, and it must be deliberative, right? That must be that the discussions must be in furtherance of a decision that could be made. Right. And so the principle, those two reasons, if either one falls, then the protections do not apply. And both of them are nonsense when it comes to what we knew about the Barr memorandum at the time, which was that this was something Bill Barr asked to be cooked up after Bill Barr had come to a decision, i.e. that it was pretextual, and that in light of the claimed deliberative process was whether to charge the president. They went into that knowing that they felt bound, or at least were going to argue that they felt bound by the OLC memorandum, that they couldn't charge the president, right? So you can't claim a deliberative process to do a thing you've already decided not to do and that you had no power to do in the first place. But once that section one was unsealed, then the DC Circuit said, that because there was never an actual charging decision to be made in this case, because the department does not rely on a mere thought experiment about whether the evidence would support a charge as to the relevant decisional process, that was an argument they made and lost on. The question naturally arises, what is the decisional process that the department believes justifies its withholding of the memorandum? The department's answer, per its briefing in our court, is that the memorandum, quote, was intended to assist the Attorney General in deciding what, if anything, to communicate to Congress and the public about whether the evidence recounted in the special counsel's report was sufficient. That is, the deliberations about whether the evidence in the report amounted to a crime went to deciding whether to say something to the public on that issue, not deciding whether to initiate a prosecution, which was never on the table, right? So they say, okay,
right.
Now, maybe you have that.
And I do have to interject here because one of my favorite things in this filing was an example they used because, you know, the Department of Justice argued, well, you know, maybe it was just a thought exercise, a hypothetical. Since we knew, you know, we weren't going to charge Donald, we were just gaming it out. Like, what if we could, you know, and that's the argument they were doubling down on. But here the court says, for instance, imagine if instead of asking for a memo assessing whether Trump had obstructed justice, imagine Bill Barr requested a memo about whether Nixon obstructed justice. And suppose he asked that question because he had simply been curious about whether Nixon committed any crimes. Of course, the attorney general could not be considering the initiation of actual criminal charges against a deceased president. Debates about whether President Nixon committed a crime thus seemingly would not qualify as pre-decisional, absent an asserted connection to some ensuing decision other than the bringing of a charge. So if you're Rosenstein and Engel and O'Callaghan and you're sitting there, well, you know, we're not going to charge him, but what if we could, and let's talk about Nixon too. Would we charge him? Blah, blah, blah. And we're talking about this in order to figure out how we're going to deliver this news to the public. Then you have a decision other than the bringing of a charge. You're deciding how you're going to present these findings to the public and using these examples. Easy as fuck argument to make. And the court here says, we probably would have granted you that.
This is where I've got to jump back in, right? I want to parse that very, very carefully because the court says, without the public component, you're just masturbating, right? mentally masturbating, right? We don't care. No deliberative process attaches to what if, right? Well, what if we wanted to charge Nixon or Thanos? Who the hell cares? You don't get deliberative process privilege if there isn't a real decision to be made at the end of it. But then they say, but wait a minute. Now the DOJ says there is a real decision to be made at the end of it, and that is the decision about whether and how to tell the public. And here, and again, you summarized it the way you did. I want to read the sentence. This is page 21. Quote, the department's view on that score might well be correct, period. Right? Then there is a page and a half of citations that's like, yeah, this is exactly a kind of a decision. It's pre-decisional, right? You don't know if and how you are going to inform the public. And it's deliberative. You got lots of different things that you might want to tell them. You know what?
And then they give specific examples of when the public affairs officials have had to deliver public statements and had deliberative processes and cases that they've gone over and over and over and over again.
All of that. And then the twisting in the knife, the department's filings in the district court, however, simply did not make or even suggest that connection. If anything, they suggested the opposite. The initial Colburn declaration stated that, quote, the attorney general announced his decision publicly in the March 2019 letter to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. That's the one that omitted three knots. Which indicated that his relevant decision was communicated in the letter, not that his relevant decision was about whether to send the letter or what to say in it. And then so they conclude, in short, while the decisional process on which the department now relies involved a determination as to whether the AG should make a public statement, none of the department's submissions to the district court suggested that the March 2019 memorandum related to such a decision. In its briefing to us, the department expresses regret that its submissions to the district court could have left the misimpression that an actual charging decision was under consideration, and it assures us that any misimpression it may have caused to that effect was inadvertent and not the result of any bad faith. Wow, I would love to have been the lawyer writing that one, right? Like, because you know what that says, right? You read between the lines. It is, I'm sorry, there was kind of a change in administration between the last time when this office was lying and now where I promise you we're not. That's a real hard thing to put in print. And the D.C. Circuit notes, still, the department at no point indicated to the district court that the memorandum gave advice on the making of a public statement. The department thus failed to carry its burden to establish the relevant decisional process. So notwithstanding that this is an interesting case, at number one, we have no indication. This order came down August the 19th, right, last Friday. And as of today, there has been no notice of appeal. We don't know. I mean, there's still time to file. We will keep an eye on this. But no
How
indication.
How long does the DOJ have to appeal? Because I noticed in this ruling, there was no schedule for appeal given. And there was also no stay given. You know, like there's no indicate, because that's my second part of the question. First, did Garland flop? And second, will he appeal this?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's only Monday and it's you know, Monday's over
right.
Just about on the East Coast. And there's still nothing from the Department of Justice as about like emergency stay request pending appeal to en banc or, you know, nothing. I don't see anything.
Yeah. And so. So there are a couple of different possibilities, right? The first and the most important question, right, is noting, right, as a background, something that we have all learned, which is filing an appeal does not, as a matter of course, stay the judgment, right? So if you wanted to appeal this decision, but also you wanted to block the document, you would need to immediately so move, right? You would need to say, hey, we are filing an emergency. This would be on the shadow docket, right? An emergency request for relief to the Supreme Court to administer it. And the way you would phrase it is, I am requesting, the DOJ is requesting administrative stay pending the filing of our cert petition. And then we will also request that if the court grants cert, that they will stay the enforcement of this judgment pending the court ruling on whether to grant cert and then its ultimate rulings there. We haven't seen any of that today. We haven't seen any indication that will happen. You have, from an adverse district court opinion, you have 30 days following the mandate to lodge your appeal, to file your cert petition in this case with the Supreme Court. And indeed, it could still be longer. I do not know if that deadline was extended during COVID, and I don't know if it's been a reduced back yet. Could be, could not be. But the important part is, you know, as we've talked about in all of these cases, you don't want to appeal this decision and still have the judgment go into effect. Right. You need administrative relief. If you're going to block this, you need the Supreme Court to know
and to issue something in the next couple of days.
That's exactly right. And if they
do it, otherwise it just gets released to citizens for responsibility against ethics in Washington. Citizens for responsibility and ethics in Washington.
There is a group of that. But
administration. They're going to get it. And they've just been saying on their Twitter, we're getting it. It's going public. Everybody, yep. We're getting it. So maybe they know that the DOJ isn't going to oppose
this. The DOJ has said they weren't. That strikes me as plausible.
But I've asked them like a million times, have you heard, are they going to appeal? Nobody can tell me. No, it's like a mystery, right? I feel like they would have done this. They would have 9 a.m. this morning. Hey, poke, we need an emergency stay pending appeal.
I think that's absolutely right. If the DOJ were intending to appeal, right, they would have had the weekend. You got staff. You would have put together a cert petition and an emergency request for a stay on the Supreme Court shadow docket. It would have been hand delivered, to the justices. And and the fact that we didn't see that leads me to believe that is not the direction this DOJ intends to go, which again, you know, I don't need to be on the side of taking a dive to say that there may be mixed views in, now given that, in other words, I would put it this way. I think if the DOJ could get a ruling that says we protect cases like this generally, but we would like to release this memorandum specifically, that would be the best of all possible worlds. And they may be looking at the things that we just read and going, oh, this is perfect, right? Like it even says in the future, we may have these avenues open to us to protect the deliberative process privilege. But, you know, not it's not going to fly in this particular case. That may be exactly what they want. So
yeah, which is why I ask if they flopped, if they said we're going to do the bare minimum here and pick up Barr's shitty arguments and do the best we can. And I just imagine Garland like saying, I'm sorry to the line prosecutors. I'm sorry you have to argue these shitty, shitty arguments, knowing there's a perfectly great, amazing argument that you could win with. But, you know, I just feel like they didn't want to win this one.
Yeah, it's tough to infer that. But I have to say that what we are left with is a situation where the request for administrative relief to seal the record is not a thing the DOJ wants. Like, I think they would love to see this memorandum get out. And
we'll know. Yeah. If they file an emergency shadow docket SCOTUS stay thing, that means they argued the best they could and sucked, and they don't want the memo to come out. I will be blown away if that happens and very upset. You will hear from me.
Me too.
And I'm also very upset about the last thing I want to talk about today. Mm. Some people keep defending this, and I can't figure out why you would defend giving 3 months to a guy in a slam dunk fucking 15 felony charge case to get basically nothing out of him except testifying against an organization where the organizations can't go to jail. So I don't understand what's going on with the Weisselberg deal. I don't like it. I know our friend Glenn Kirshner also doesn't like it, but Weissman thinks it's great. I can't understand. Can you help me?
I expressed these exact sentiments on the last opening arguments. I agree with you. I have great respect for Alan Weissman. Like, I know this isn't my lane. So, you know, if folks want to say, you know, stay in your own lane, stay out of mine, I'm sensitive to that. But I look at this. So, yeah, we should, for the interest of accuracy, it's a 5-month sentence. It will be 3 months and a week, considering time served, right?
He was facing like nine years.
15 years potentially in prison. He's 75. That would have been the rest of his natural life. And yeah, the reason you take a plea deal is one of two things, right? Number one, I guess three things, right? Number one, you take it because you're getting something else of value, right? So you are
of value,
right? So you are reducing the sentence somebody ought to serve in recognition for the fact that they're doing a thing of value to the justice system. Number two, you take it when there are uncertainties, when you are face severe doubts about whether you could prove a particular charge or not. And again, as you and I have said, these are well-documented, teed up. You know, this was, and again, almost all of that work was done by Cy Vance, right? Was set up on a tee.
And done in Pomerantz, who resigned in protest and disgust, saying, we're out of here, you fucking piece. You're not going to seriously slam dunk case. You're not going to charge Trump. We're out. Peace out.
And was designed to squeeze Weisselberg, right? Like to say, oh, you've resisted. Because we've seen the, you know, reports of, well, is Weisselberg going to flip? And, you know, ultimately those turned out to be no. And so what you do then is you say, all right, man, you're 75. I'm going to put you away for 15 years. And if Weisselberg stares you in the face and says, well, I would rather do 15 years than flip on Donald Trump, you go, okay, well, so maybe we have to open up an investigation on how your kid got into that, you know, super swanky school in Manhattan. Maybe we're going to have to take a look at your family relations. And at some point, you look for him to say, all right, man.
Or you take him to trial and put him away for 15 years.
There you go. That's the thing is that that's what
you
people
don't
are not
need his testimony to win the case against the Trump Organization. You don't. I mean, it's nice.
And
but
your third point there was, I thought, by far the most critical. if you get Alan Weisselberg's cooperation to win a case against the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg is the Trump Organization for folks not named Trump, right? So if you're not going after individuals whose surname is Trump, then getting a conviction, cutting a deal with the CFO to get a criminal conviction against an LLC, a privately held LLC, is literally the dumbest thing I could possibly imagine, right?
Yeah, because like, explain real quick what happens if Weisselberg's testimony is the thing that nails the case, the criminal case against an organization. What happens to that organization? So, fines?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things that can happen. Number one, in some cases, very, very rare, executives from an organization that has been adjudged to have broken the law can serve prison terms. That's not going to be the case here because the highest ranking person in the Trump organization who could possibly serve a prison term is going to be Weisselberg, and he will have double jeopardy protection on those crimes, right? So you're not going to get him to serve on behalf of the Trump org, and no court is going to order, like, you know, Weisselberg's deputy accountant to go to prison over what happened, right? So you could have fines against the organization, or, right, you could have, under New York state law, you could order the dissolution of the organization. And before, you know, again, the Pollyanna start coming out and saying, like, well, see, that would be like, this is not like disbanding the National Rifle Association, right? Disbanding the National Rifle Association was a great thing, because it had, you know, huge bank accounts and relationships and all of that. And it's difficult to kind of rebuild those sorts of things. The Trump Organization is a personal services company run by the Trump family. If it got disbanded tomorrow, then the day afterwards, right, Eric, Ivanka, Don Jr. could start the Trump 2 family organization, right? Like
Tish James is going to do this anyway. So right. Why are you just,
this was supposed to be the criminal side of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And I get it. You might say, right. And this is in fact what I believe has happened, right? Which is, they've said, all right, we've decided we're not going after Trump. Well, if we're not going after Trump, why are we screwing around with this Weisselberg guy? Like, he's already said he's not going to flip. You only want him to flip if you want him to flip on Trump. And he's told us to go fuck ourselves. So, all right, just cut it, you know, whatever, be done with it. But, like, whatever be done with it should be take him to trial. Right. Should be. Oh, hey. All right. Question. Are you going to cooperate? Are you going to serve as a cooperating witness or not? He says no. Cool. See you in court in October. Right.
And, these are slam dunk cases. I don't care.
The people who are saying you have secured, you don't have his cooperation, but you know, he is required to testify. Woo. Yeah. Great. Somebody who has sat in closed door hearings and said to you, I will lie to you about Donald Trump. You now are going to procure his testimony? Like, what? Like, A, no, you're not, right?
yeah, that's another thing, too, is that there's indications that he violated an immunity during testimony to a federal grand jury. And that's kind of what led to this. So why?
He's
are they letting him off the hook?
He's a serial liar and defender of Donald Trump. And, yeah. And look, again, we know when these turn out to be good, and they don't necessarily turn out to be good deals, right? But we know the process that happens here, right? Which is when you sign someone to a cooperation deal, this is the analogy is Paul Manafort, right? Like all of a sudden, if you realize, oh, hey, this guy hasn't flipped at all, he's feeding us disinformation and bullshit, and he hasn't cooperated. The terms of revoking the cooperation deal are the subjective satisfaction of the DOJ. That's super easy to prove. You just have to get an affidavit from somebody that's like, hey, Weisselberg said he was going to cooperate and he stopped cooperating. And the court's like, did you? And, you know, and again, Paul Manafort went into court and was like, no, I absolutely continue to cooperate. Look at all the documents I have given them. And the DOJ was like, he's jerking us around. And the court was like, yep, all right. The deal was cooperation. The party with whom you were supposed to cooperate says you're jerking them around. Therefore, you're jerking them around and we're revoking the deal. That's how you ensure that somebody testifies, is mm-hmm. you sign them to a cooperation deal. When you don't, then what you're left with, and these are the arguments that people like Weissman have been making, which is, well, you know, if he lies, then, you know, you could go get him for perjury.
No.
And
why
it's
would
like,
you, why would you waste time on a perjury when you had him on 15 felony tax counts?
I just say to you, again, I would like for this to be the case. List for me the number of perjury convictions that you have seen in the past 5 years. List the number of perjury trials you have seen in
the
last 5 years.
No, but Andrew, you don't understand. This is all an awesome plan worked out ahead of time to get him on a perjury charge.
This is not how you set up a perjury trap. And, you know, when people were saying, like, the judge read it out solemnly and said, if you violate any of the terms of the agreement, you serve out the full sentence. That's judges do that every time you sign a plea deal.
Yeah, that's not new. That's how it goes.
The only thing that gives me a little bit of pause, and Weissman said this on the Sunday shows a week and a half at the time this goes to air. This does not contain a scope clause, right? It does not say that we will not charge you again in the future for related crimes. Usually you get that, right? When you get a plea deal, you get you're pleading guilty to these 15 crimes. We agree we won't bring those charges against you or any substantially similar charges, right? Or, you know, it might say relating to or arising out of the same transaction or something like that.
Right.
Or, you know, since this goes back. And I agree it doesn't contain a scope clause, but to me, the most parsimonious explanation of that is that when Weisselberg said, well, I'm not cooperating, then the DOJ was like, fine, or not the DOJ, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was like, okay, fine, if you're not cooperating, you're not getting a scope clause. And then I think Weisselberg's attorneys were like, they're not going to bring additional charges against you. Whatever, sign it anyway, right? Like, because then the ball is in Weisselberg's court, right? Like, he can come back and go, I'd really like a scope clause, right? And Alvin Bragg could be like, I'd really like a pony. and then the question is, do you still sign this or not? And at the end of the day, right, again, not my lane, I get it, but if I'm Weisselberg's attorneys, you know, and he asked me, all right, well, I didn't get the scope clause. Should I still take the deal? You're like, oh God, yes, you should still take the deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100 days, 15 felonies, and I don't have to testify against the guy who I wasn't going to testify against?
Yeah.
Sign me up.
So me I up. Don't...
This is a sweetheart deal and I hate it.
If the whole point, let's go back to, let's zoom out a level of resolution, right? The whole point on wanting there to be state charges that stick are charges against the former guy from jurisdictions that if goddamn Ron DeSantis turns out to be our next president, he can't pardon Trump out of. That's why you want this. And in my view, there is no way to look at this and go, this brings us closer to state charges against Donald Trump in New York. It just doesn't. And even if everything went the optimist way, you would have to be like, okay, well, now we got damning testimony in a trial against Trump org, and now we got to go back to the beginning and reopen the possibility that we're going to charge Trump. And it's just like,
no,
it's not going to happen.
You would have charged him in January when you got there.
These are real estate valuations, right? These are done deals.
The only thing that would make me okay with this deal is if it had something to do with ratting on Trump in a federal IRS investigation.
Yeah, to which we have, and again, understanding that, you know, this Attorney General plays it close to the vest,
because
we have no indication of that.
Well, we have a little tiny hint of that in that Weisselberg had to agree to plead guilty to those crimes, and state and federal crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So that he did have to say that he also violated federal crimes.
Yeah.
Why would he have to do that? So if there's some sort of a deal with Southern District or, you know, something's going on there, okay. And I'll
do an Andrew was wrong if that's the case, but this.
No, we won't be wrong, because we'll say that this is the only time it would be acceptable.
Fair enough. But
we'll be right. We'll be correct. We'll be like, look, here it is. It's true. He was cooperating against Donald Trump. I doubt it.
Yeah, I want to take the under on that. So
yeah, but if that does happen, if we find out that the reason he had to also say that Trump was guilty of federal stuff was so that the Southern District of New York or the IRS could run with with Trump stuff, you know, for federal crimes. Okay, if that was stuck in there for that, and that's what got him 100 days. Sorry, 5 months. fine.
Yeah.
I'll be cool with that. Although
we'll
I still
see.
Don't think this deal was necessary to get that done.
The feds don't need.
I mean, it would help the feds if the feds were investigating to get that guilty plea from the CFO of the Trump Organization. It would help their case.
And I just want to end on this, right? That there is a kind of understandable monomania among those of us who are progressives I don't want to see Donald Trump left out from being held accountable, right? And I get that. I feel that. I argue that every single day. But let's not fall into the reverse trap, which is that only convictions of the former guy count, right? There are a lot of scumbags in play here. And Alan Weisselberg is a scumbag of the highest order. He has spent decades covering up, conspiring with Donald Trump to commit frauds from, you know, the petty, you know, to the sublime, the, you know, having Mar-a-Lago buy a painting of himself to satisfy the town, to discharge that town debt for violating the height ordinance, to, you know, the truly disgusting. And he's somebody who should be in jail for a long time. Right. John Eastman should be in jail for a long time. Right. These people who were in on the ground floor, Rudy Giuliani should be in prison for a long time. So, you know, that's part of what's disappointing here is that, OK, you know, you can't get useful information because he's not going to flip. He's, you know, he's decided he's going to be, Alan Tightlips. Great. Put him away. Put him away for a long goddamn time. Go to trial. Do your jobs.
Well, here's hoping the IRS will do that. And maybe they're just doing it separate and has nothing to do with it.
That's 87,000 new agents. They all have Weisselberg tattooed on their eyelids. That'll be good.
Yeah, right. All right. That is our show. I just want to let everybody know last minute here that Donald has filed his lawsuit related to the search warrant. It's on the docket, but there's no document associated with it yet. But it's there, U.S. District Court, Southern District of Florida. We'll see what it says. But, you know, 100%, it's not even going to get to the merits. It's going to be procedurally dismissed.
Yep.
And it's stupid, and it's way too late. And the only reason that he's filing this is because Laura Ingraham actually made a fool of Christina Bob on Fox News.
Yes, she did.
And in Trump circles, there was like, that's terrible. Why haven't we filed anything? Laura's right. Why haven't we filed? And so that's why this is happening. And it's the only reason it's happening. And Jim Trusty is probably like, what the fuck do you want me to file? You have no case.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Sorry we didn't get to bring that to the listeners, but
we had a lot to go over today.
Appreciate the late breaking news. No, this is uh This has been Clean Up on Aisle 45. I'm Andrew Torres.
I'm Allison Gill. We'll see you next week. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.
They might be giants that have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And they might be giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now they might be giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one. This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
Securing your agency's data is paramount. IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, offers a tailored solution for federal agencies. Protecting sensitive data isn't just about safeguarding. It's about ensuring availability, recovery, and reliability to support mission-critical operations. As an IBM Platinum partner, 4Inc trusts IBM API Connect, integrated with Noname Security, for unmatched speed and efficiency in securing, accessing, and ensuring the integrity of vital data. Visit FOURINC.com.